fight. Them up for the people, Mr. Crassy for the root.
This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. President Joe Biden's administration on Thursday released a summary of after-action reports on the U.S. chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan that laid blame on his predecessor, Donald Trump, saying there were no signs that more time, more funds, or more Americans could have fundamentally changed the trajectory. We get more on the story from Reuters' Tamara Lindstrom.
The White House on Thursday released a summary of the after-action reports on the chaotic U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, laying part of the blame on President Joe Biden's predecessor, Donald Trump.
President Biden inherited a forced presence in Afghanistan of some 2,500 troops, and he inherited a deal struck between the previous administration and the Taliban that called for the complete removal of all U.S. troops by May of 2021, or else the Taliban, which had stopped its attacks while the deal was in place, would go back to war against the United States.
Kirby said the Trump administration was not forthcoming when asked for withdrawal plans, affording little in the way of transition between the administrations.
That was Tamara Lindstrom reporting. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu late Thursday vowed to retaliate after a barrage of rockets from Lebanon added to already simmering tensions in the country. Netanyahu spoke during a meeting of the Security Cabinet assembled to discuss the worsening security situation. Israel's military has said militants in Lebanon fired a barrage of rockets at Israel, forcing people across Israel's northern frontier area into bomb shelters, wounding at least two people and damaging property. Similar tensions in Jerusalem led to an 11-day war between Israel and Hamas in 2021. This is VOA News. The head of the Sudanese army said on Thursday he remained committed to a plan for a new transition towards elections, despite disputes over the integration of a paramilitary force that have twice delayed the signing of a final deal. The agreement, which provides for information of a civilian government and is strongly supported by the international community, is meant to end the political vacuum that is following the October 2021 overthrow of longtime autocratic ruler Omar al-Bashir. The agreement faces opposition from pro-democracy resistance committees that reject negotiations with the military and have led anti-military protests since the coup, which derailed a previous political transition. China's leader has called for peace talks over Ukraine after France's president urged him to bring Russia to its senses. We get more on the story from the AP's Karen Chalmers.
At a joint news briefing in Beijing, China's Xi Jinping said, resume peace talks as soon as possible, in accordance with the purposes and principles of the UN Charter, take into account the legitimate security concerns of all parties. Xi, however, gave France's President Emmanuel Macron no assurances that he would use his close diplomatic relationship with Russia's President Vladimir Putin as leverage to push for peace. Beijing sees Moscow as a strategic partner in the face of U.S. domination in global affairs. Whilst China's government has tried to remain neutral, it has given Putin diplomatic support and has repeated Russian justifications for the February 2022 attack. I'm Karen Chamas.
The Biden administration is proposing stopping schools and colleges across the country from fully banning transgender athletes. AP correspondent Sagar Magani has that story.
It's a political counterpunch as GOP-led states try to ban trans athletes from school sports that align with their gender identities. The rule would stop any school or college getting federal funding from categorically banning trans students from sports teams consistent with their gender identity. But it's nearly certain to face challenges, and the rule would let teams create some limits for things like ensuring fairness in competition or reducing injury risks. The proposal comes as international sports governing bodies move to ban all trans athletes from track and field events and effectively ban trans women from swimming events. Sagar Magani, Washington.
And as always, for details on much more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com, or the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, April 7th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Today, April 7th, is World Health Day.
We have shortages of health workers. We have shortages of health facilities. And as Africa CDC, one very core part of our work is to strengthen our health institutions, to strengthen our health workers' capacity.
We'll discuss the impact of private and public debt on developing countries. South Sudan's Bureau of Statistics launches a population survey for 2021. Peter Obi, the man who came third in Nigeria's February 25 presidential elections, said this week that he is under pressure to leave the country.
Peter Obi has come out to say he is not going anywhere. Neither are we. We are all here in Nigeria, and we are going to battle this illegality legally.
And some rights activists are warning against any U.S. sanctions on African governments that criminalize homosexuality. Those stories for Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. April 7th is World Health Day, a time to raise awareness around health issues that affect people all over the globe. According to the World Health Organization, millions of people globally do not receive the medical treatment and the prevention tools they need. Many of them are in low- and middle-income countries, including Africa. This year's World Health Day focuses on health for all. Dr. Agme Owell Ouma is the acting director of the Africa Center for Disease Control and Prevention. He tells viewers Linor Mondu that delivering health for all is key for improving outcomes on the continent.
This World Health Day on the 7th of April, and the theme, Health for All, is at the core of our work as Africa CDC. We do everything so that everyone is protected from disease threats and health emergencies, meaning we are delivering health for all. We do everything so that the reservoirs of diseases and different pathogens in the animal and in the environment are contained before they affect the health of animals or human beings. This is us delivering health for all. Beyond human beings, we are also delivering health for the animal and the environment parts of society. Thirdly, the need for improving the capacity on the continent to deliver health for all is with us every day. We have shortages of health workers. We have shortages of health facilities. We have shortages of health products. And as Africa CDC, one very core part of our work is to strengthen our health institutions, to strengthen our health workers' capacity, and also to ensure that health products are being manufactured on the continent and therefore more easily available.
What are your thoughts on the average African patient who is faced with maybe some health challenges every day? What does a theme like this mean for that patient, health for all, if that person doesn't really have access?
That is really the majority of the Africans having challenges with access to quality healthcare. Our role as Africa CDC is threefold for somebody like that on the African continent. One is keeping them safer, meaning we want to keep disease away from the communities. And we do that by working with the communities, providing them with the right information, which they then consume within their own contexts and cultures. They avoid disease. The second aspect is ensuring that when diseases visit a community, we can be able to identify those diseases quickly and therefore reduce the risks of that disease spreading beyond the original person that had been affected. The third is we work with our governments to expand the reach of the health system to the communities. Our role is to ensure that governments have the capacity to understand, appreciate, plan for that expansion of the health system so that everybody has access to good quality healthcare.
That was Dr. Agme Owell Ouma, acting director of the Africa CDC. He was speaking to my colleague Linor Mondu from Addis Ababa. If the world's poorest countries and some developing countries fail to address the debt they owe to public and private creditors, they don't have a chance of recovering. That's the conclusion of a new report by the Boston University Global Development Policy Center and the Debt Relief for a Green and Inclusive Recovery Project. The report was released yesterday, Thursday, just days before next week's World Bank Group and International Monetary Fund Spring meetings. Kevin Gallagher is the project's co-author and director of the Development Policy Center. He tells viewers Carol Van Damme, negotiating with transitional governments like Sudan and South Sudan is especially tricky because the World Bank and IMF officials do not know who will be in charge in the near future.
It's very difficult, and you're sort of damned if you do and damned if you don't. If you don't negotiate and you don't get liquidity into these countries, it'll only get worse. But then sometimes you could be gambling because there could, oftentimes some of these programs, things get so bad that there is a change in power during it. And this is where a lot of parties need to get involved. These are contractual agreements that are negotiated. You might negotiate it with a particular individual who's the president, but it's on behalf of the whole country. So that whoever is in power is supposed to honor the outcomes. But obviously, if there's lots of change in the middle of the negotiations, it can make it prolonged.
And some of those countries, like you mentioned, you know, the economy is just spiraling downward so quickly, and the foreign exchange rate terrible. Do you try to step in for those countries too?
Yeah, the purpose of the International Monetary Fund is to be the lender of last resort. And so that's our role, right? We're there to plug that hole. When PIMCO says no more, when the World Bank says, I can't give you any more because we see that you're taking our money and you're paying PIMCO or paying the China Development Bank. If the International Monetary Fund, one of its major functions, basically has two major functions. One is to give countries advice and be surveilling the global economy all the time to make sure this stuff doesn't happen. Sometimes they don't see it. Sometimes they can't prevent it. And when it does happen, it's there to be that lender. And that's their specialty. It's messy. Countries should be going to these institutions earlier. But there's a stigma attached. Sometimes these programs don't work as well as they're supposed to. Now, there's a big conversation in Washington next week because the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund are having their spring meetings. And there's a big call for sort of more fundamental reforms to these institutions, because if they were working well, countries would have gone to the IMF in 2020 when things really started to get stressful. It imposes what they call fiscal consolidation, or some people more flippantly call austerity, where you have to adjust to the new environment. So if you have to pay your new international debts back, they'll give you a little bit of money. But in large part, you have to adjust by cutting spending to pay back your international debts. That's not what we do in the North. And that causes deepens recessions and causes a lot of social strife in these countries. And that's why there's a big stigma. And so many African countries in 2020, some of them went to get more money from China at 4 or 5%. So that was a little bit better than the but to me, as an economist, that says something about the preferences of countries and the state of the system. We've got a safety net that is almost free money at 1%.
That was economist Kevin Gallagher, co-chair of the Debt Relief for Green and Inclusive Recovery Project. He is also a director of Boston University's Global Development Policy Center. He was speaking from Boston with my colleague Carol Van Damme. South Sudan's National Bureau of Statistics released a report of population estimates from a survey carried out in 2021. The Bureau says there are 12 million people in the country. Isaiah Cho Arua, the chairperson of the Bureau, says the data could be used by policymakers and other groups for service delivery. For VOA News, Juliana Shepai has more from Juba.
Isaiah Chor-Arwai, the head of the National Bureau of Statistics, say his team was unable to complete the report on time due to several challenges, including flooding and local insecurity, which disrupted the enumeration exercise in some areas.
The figures that we have come up with are based on the satellite imagery and the enumeration that was done after that in terms of the methodology. So in our view, as the National Bureau of Statistics, we believe that these figures can only be used for policy formulation or planning and for service delivery. They may not necessarily be used for elections, simply because the figures that eliminate or emanate from the survey may not necessarily be suitable for conducting the population and housing census.
South Sudan's Minister of Finance and Planning, Dier Taungor, says the data from the survey will help the government of South Sudan and its partners plan for other crucial future surveys in the country.
You all know that an efficient national system for the generation and dissemination of population data and demographic intelligence, including in a humanitarian setting, is critical for evidence-based planning and decision-making. In this regard, we once again acknowledge the support of the UN and of the United Nations Fund for Population Activities for providing technical assistance to the National Bureau of Statistics in its capacity building, as was done during the PES process.
Ademola Olajide is the country's representative for the United Nations Population Fund, or UNFPA, in South Sudan. He says the report is a micro-census which provides data for planning and the policy formulation meant to foster development of the country.
Indeed, we all have a key role in our cooperation framework with the government of South Sudan in strengthening the use of evidence for development planning, and that is very critical in strengthening the capacity of the Bureau of Statistics. They remain a critical, very important implementing partner for us, and so we have a plan within our country program, as do other UN agencies, to continue to support that agency to build its capacity.
Peter van den Aurit says humanitarian agencies will use the data for planning services delivery across the country.
For the United Nations globally, population data is something very important. Again, not just to collect data as a purpose or an objective by itself, but as a foundation for achieving the sustainable development goals.
The head of the National Bureau of Statistics says his office is compiling a detailed report with analysis of demographic and socio-economic characteristics. He says the report will be shared for demographic dividends modeling. For VOA News, I am Juliana Shiapai in Juba.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I am James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, April 7th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. Nigeria, Peter Obi of the Labour Party, the man who came third in Nigeria's February 25 presidential elections, said this week that he was under pressure to leave the country. His statement follows the release of a leaked audio on social media in which Obi is said to have asked for help from a bishop, David Oyedepo, of the Winners Chapel. He also reportedly described the February 25 election as a religious war. Obi said the audio was fake and accused the ruling All Progressive Congress Party of propaganda. Labour Party spokesperson Yanusa Tanko explains to me that Obi ran a campaign based on issues and not on tribalism and religion.
After presenting our court case, they brought out a propaganda, a concocted statement that Obi was soliciting for Christian support through Archbishop Oyedepo, which of course was a concocted lie, because Obi has stayed consistent on the issue of issue-based campaign, and he has also maintained that you shouldn't vote for him because he's a Christian, nor vote for him because he comes from a certain part of the country. This has been established. Knowing fully well that he has already been able to resonate with the Nigerian youth, they now brought in the issue of division of tribal and religious sentiments. While they are the ones who actually run on the Muslim-Muslim ticket, ignoring the Christendom faith in Nigeria. At the same time, they are now using cronies and surrogates to tell him to leave the country so that they can perpetuate the heinous crime against the people. And Peter Obi has come out and said he is not going anywhere. Neither are we. We are all here in Nigeria, and we are going to battle this illegality legally.
But let me ask you, who is telling Peter Obi to leave the country?
Oh, individuals call on phone to tell him that they are advising him that it is better for him to leave the country, that this country is not safe for him and all. So it has gone to that level. of level of threat to life and threat to our family. But we are resolute and focused. Nigeria is our kettle of fish, and we will make sure that we defend it.
I'm kind of confused. Why would the APC or the government or whoever it is want to threaten Mr. Obi or you? In fact, you just had an election. The election is over, although there's still some court proceedings. Why would somebody want to threaten you?
One, because we hold the aims. Our court case is very solid and cannot be tampered with. Considering the fact that we're challenging the legality of Tinubu for contesting the election, we're challenging because he did not provide his prerequisite document for contesting the election. Two, we are also challenging the fact that he was already a charged felon in the United States on drug issues. We're challenging that. We're also challenging the process of the election, which has been contradicted by INEC itself by not posting the results on the IRS server as enshrined by the provision of the Electoral Act and pronounced by INEC itself. And so all the votes that were already being enshrined to Tinubu and his political party were null and void. And we are also challenging the simple fact that he did not win 25% and enshrined by the Constitution of the Federal Republic of Nigeria in the Federal Capital Territory. And so on these five count charges, we are asking that the election should be annulled and redone. So in that case, we are already a threat to the calling or actually inauguration of this so-called president. And we command a lot of respect from the Nigerian people, especially the Nigerian youth. So we are being seen as a threat. And that is the reason why we must get out of the country or being advised to get out of the country so that they can actually constitute their illegality against the Nigerian state.
Yanusa Tanko is the spokesperson for Nigeria's Labour Party of Peter Obi. He was speaking with us from Lagos. Some rights activists are warning against suggestions that the United States should impose broad sanctions against African governments and act in laws to criminalize homosexuality. They say blanket sanctions could further harm the LGBTQ plus community on the continent. Instead, they recommend targeted sanctions on politicians and sponsors of anti-gay legislation. VOA's Initial Anon has this report.
During her recent trip to Africa, U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris told journalists about her approach to anti-homosexuality measures some African countries are moving to pass.
I feel very strongly about the importance of supporting the freedom and supporting and fighting for equality among all people, and that all people be treated equally. I will also say that this is an issue that we consider and I consider to be a human rights issue, and that will not change.
She made the comment in Ghana, the first stop of her trip last week. Other senior U.S. officials such as John Kirby, the National Security Council spokesperson, have expressed strong sentiments. He said Kampala risks, quote, repercussions that may be in an economic way, end of quote, if Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni signed a new anti-homosexuality bill into law.
And that would be really unfortunate because so much of the economic assistance that we provide Uganda is health assistance, and largely through PEPFAR.
PEPFAR is a U.S. program for fighting HIV/AIDS on the continent. Kirby's position alarms some rights activists who say, although they support targeted sanctions against homophobic laws in African states, blanket sanctions will gravely impact African LGBTQ plus persons. Nicholas Opio is founder and executive director at Chapter 4 Uganda, a Kampala-based civil society organization.
Any approach must be smart, smart sanctions, in the sense that it safeguards those who are benefiting from U.S. aid in Uganda, but makes those who finance, who propagate this hateful campaign feel the pinch.
Robert Akoto Omwafo is the advocacy manager at the Pan-African ILGA, or the International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans and Intersex Association.
Sanctions that will ensure that these people understand that when they do something, there are consequences. Homophobia must be punished, like how any other offense is punished. So if a politician has their child in Harvard and they are harming anybody in Ghana, their children should be brought back. If we pull such support, it may affect education, which LGBT people need to get access to. Already, LGBT people are limited to access these services.
Ghana Speaker of Parliament Alban Sumana Kingsford-Bagbin took a swipe at the U.S. Vice President for her comments on LGBTQ plus rights in the West African nation, calling them, quote, undemocratic, end of quote.
We need to legislate. Our friends just passed their law in Uganda. We may not go the way they have gone. What is democracy? That somebody else will have to dictate to me as to what is good and what is bad.
Ghana's legislature is debating an anti-LGBTQ plus bill which seeks to criminalize with up to 5 years in prison individuals identifying as LGBTQI plus or having a gay relationship. Uganda's Opio said LGBTQ plus persons in Africa could face further harm if the US and other partners do not heed to their plea to use only limited sanctions.
Any response to the Ugandan law will determine what will happen in other African countries. But if these sanctions are imposed, a couple of things are going to happen. I think that the population will think that the LGBT community have the responsibility for these sanctions being imposed. The community will turn against LGBT individuals even in far worse ways than it has in the past.
Many rights advocates note that broad sanctions could reduce aid for roads, schools and medical care, which benefit everyone, including LGBTQI plus individuals. Ignatius Anno, VOA News, Washington.
It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the inaugural Confederation of African Football African Schools Football Championship Final, which is currently holding in South Africa. A total of $300,000 is up for grabs for both the winners of the boys and girls competitions. The school soccer event kicked off on Wednesday, the 5th of April, and the final will be played on Saturday, the 8th of April. The final will be played at the King Zwelithini Stadium. The Musepe Foundation has donated over $1 million in prize money for the school soccer tournament, making it the richest schools event on African soil. Veron Musengo Omar is the CAF Secretary General.
This program means a world for CAF. You know, they have a lot of functionality there. It is to enjoy football, to have education, and we're using also to vehicle the value of football to our kids.
Staying with CAF, record champions Al Hockley and Morocco's Raja Casablanca face off in the quarterfinals of the CAF Champions League for a second consecutive season after the two North African giants were paired in Wednesday's evening's draw. The two sides also faced off at the same stage last season, with the Egyptians winning 3-2 on aggregate after a 2-1 victory at home and a 1-1 draw in Casablanca. Raja, who are unbeaten in the competition this season, will be out to exact revenge on Al Hakli, who squeezed through to the last eight on the last day of the group stages. In other quarterfinal pairings, defending champions Wydad Casablanca will play Tanzanian side Simba SC, with the first leg set to be staged in Dar es Salaam. 2016 champions Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa will continue their campaign for a second title, with the first leg of their quarterfinals in Algeria against CR Belouizdad. Another Algerian side, JS Kabylie, will host Esperance of Tunisia, another enticing North African derby. The quarterfinals are scheduled for the weekend of April 21st to the 22nd, and the return fixtures a week later. Staying with football news, Morocco's Atlas Lions are now ranked as the best football team in Africa. In the latest FIFA ranking released on Thursday, Morocco maintained their 11th position in the world, but number one in Africa. Senegal is the second best football team, followed by Tunisia, Algeria, and Egypt wraps up the top five. Away from football news now to athletics, Ethiopian Lemechia Girma, who set a world indoor 3,000 meters record earlier this year, will face former 1,500 meters world champion Kenya's Timothy Cheruiyot at the Doha Diamond League meeting next month. The field includes Cheruiyot's Kenyan compatriot Ishmael Kipkiri, who is the reigning world under-20 cross-country champion, as well as three other winners of global titles. And that will be all for this Good Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a nice weekend. And that's it for this Friday, April 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. I am James Bob.